Hi, my name is Chris Nader. I'm the co-founder of Envy Lodges. I'm a big fan of SMAC, and this is my episode.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to your favorite podcast out there. Today, we've got a special treat for you. Not only did our guest, Chris Nader from Envy Lodges, share some truly helpful tips with us on what to keep in mind when starting your own business and told us what he learned about building a truly sustainable brand, but he also shared some exclusive news with us about Envy Lodges' expansion plans. So without further ado, turn your volume up and enjoy the show. So, Chris, thank you so much for joining SMAC today, for taking the time. Welcome to your episode.
Thank you. I'm super excited to be here. I've been listening to a few of your episodes and, I'm glad that my turn has come now.
Yeah, you were telling us in the pre-call that we had that you might be the most informed and knowledgeable listener and that comes on the podcast, actually. So now we need to step up our game. So I'm excited for this one. And we're going to start really easy and slow. I've read on multiple, websites when I was stalking you that you're not the first one in your family to work in hospitality. So I'd be very curious to learn a bit more about, your family's, history in our industry and how you got into it. And if you even had a choice.
Yeah, actually, they tried to convince me not to join the industry for many years, but then I won. It also actually started with my grandparents after World War II, where they decided to buy a piece of land by the beach to create a beach club and a yacht club to kind of set new standards in tourism back home where I come from, which is Lebanon. And we owned that business for about 50 years. So from the grandparents, this was then given to, their two kids, one of them my father. And I was born in this environment. It's like it was normal to go to, to the family business in summer and work there at a young age. We could spend some days having fun at the beach, but quickly I started realizing that, okay, I had enough of sun now and swimming and stuff like that. Let me try different aspects of the business. One of which was actually the kitchen. Getting into the kitchen, not from a cooking standpoint, but understanding how the process of the kitchen works in terms of orders and preparations and checking that all is good before you send it to a table. Then I moved to the bar. Again, I was a teenager, so not from an alcohol consumption standpoint, but I was also keen to understand the business aspect of how you record beverages and the pricing and the costings. I was doing some of that. I did a few fun stuff, when it came to beach activities, etc. And after we sold the business, my brother wanted to kind of keep going into that entrepreneurial journey. So he set up his own company to manage other beach clubs and restaurants and bars. And naturally, I said, hey, I want to work as well for you and with you. He was very tough on me. He wanted to set an example saying, basically, it's not because you're my brother that I have to give you special treatments. I'm going to show the other employees that you're going to be suffering the most. And that's how you're going to learn. I did suffer on a few occasions. I even got fired. He fired me one day.
Oh, wow.
But I came back the next day. And this is how I really started getting into the F&B scene and the nightlife scene and taking multiple F&B roles from cleaning, the dishes and the cups and stuff at the back to moving to a support function, then getting into a bar, then moving into a supervisor role, and a manager role. And then came the time where I said, okay, what I want to do with my life? And I said, I want to do a hotel school. And all of them said, absolutely not. You're not going to work in hospitality. This is a very tough business. You don't get paid well. You work hard and long hours. when everyone is on holidays, you're working. And then when your time comes for holidays, there's no one to go with you because they're all working. It's like really in reverse mode. It's like, go do something, you know, different. And one day I, you know, after a few years of being lost, I had the courage with the support of one of my family members to say, listen, let me now do my GMAT. I want to enter an MBA in hospitality. I did my business degree before, but I want to focus on hospitality. And that's how I got into EHL. And it was just the most amazing experience that I've had until in my studies.
So, but that's actually a really, really wonderful story, right? Because people are like, you were kind of not really encouraged to choose to go down this path, but nothing could keep you from going there anyways. And you really, you know, you worked your way up, you saw so many different aspects of the industry, and you still, you know, decided to go into it, which I always think is the best way to do it, right? So I think it's always hard when people only see the glamorous side of hotels and they stay at a five-star property and they're like, oh, I want to work in hotels. And then, you know, the reality is quite different. So
serving people is really one of the most difficult thing, because by nature, people are not happy. They want to complain, you know, especially at the luxury end, when you're paying, you know, big dollars, you know, any small mistake, they take it to big, you know, kind of dimensions. But yeah, there was something in me, I guess, you know, serving, providing an experience, seeing a smile on someone's face, trying to make sure that people enjoy their time. You know, this is what really kept me going into the industry. And I felt it was just, you know, a very exciting business in general.
Well, we're happy you stuck around. And you just mentioned that, especially in the luxury segment, you know, people tend to be, well, they have very high expectations because they are paying a lot for their experiences, right? So when you were done with your MBA, you chose this very special part of our industry, let's say, like the luxury segment, to start your career. Can you share a bit more about, you know, your decision and why you chose that to start your career that way?
Yeah, I think the hotel school in Lausanne, EHL, although I did 1 year an MBA, but let's take a student who does, you know, the November 4 years program. We are formed in an environment that has very high standards, you know, in the way we dress, in the way we get these etiquette classes, the type of stage you do at the fine dining restaurant, the type of products that you use at school, the type of companies that come to you and the CEOs that you meet. It's very more geared toward the luxury space. So for many students, when you're graduate or when you get close to graduating, you know, you start ticking the boxes. I want to try Four Seasons. I want to try Mandarin Oriental, you know, AMA. And when, you know, you really try to, very few people say, I want to work for a budget brand, you know, when they graduate. And no offense, it's just the way, you know, the student in general think. And for me, I think partly it was also that, you know, having something prestigious on a CV. But my decision was more driven by finding a company that has a niche positioning. And I've always been drawn to brands that offer something different, that are niche, that are specialized. I was never excited by, you know, big brands that just are very generic. So my choices were more driven by that. And the luxury aspect came as the cherry on top.
And I mean, it is a good school in a way, like, you know, the five-star properties or the luxury segment. This is where usually your supervisors are very strict. You always have to perform. You're at the highest level of the game, let's say. So I do think I mean, I worked in five stars as well when I started out. I think it has a certain draw. And you always think, okay, when you can do this, you're fine. Like you have proven that you can, perform at this level, and then you can find your own thing or your own way into the industry. So I do think what you said is correct, right? Like that's also how it's portrayed. Like that's the end goal. That's kind of the Champions League that you're aiming for. So why not start there to begin with?
Correct. I mean, you see in a Michelin star restaurant, you see how the waiters work and the level of perfection that they have to achieve in their service. When they leave, these guys can work anywhere and it'll be a piece of cake for them.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. But then, so you stayed in, let's say, the luxury end of our industry for quite a bit. You had different positions. You also worked in development, just as me. So tough department as well, but also a really fun one. And then after more than 10 years, you decided to, you know, go down a different path and start your own entrepreneurial journey. And that's quite different, right? Like leaving the corporate, let's say, world a bit behind and starting your own thing. So I'm very curious to learn if, you know, you always had this in your like back of your mind, or if this was something that came a bit out of nowhere for you, maybe yourself.
Out of completely nowhere. It was like a dark place that I never thought I had in my mind. It was actually, you know, I always thought that I would start in a large corporation that, you know, specializes in what I like to do, and that I will move from, you know, manager to director to vice president to chief something, and that was it really. The fact that I decided to jump ship was really driven by a few factors about, you know, what really motivates you as an individual, where you see yourself, what is out there available that, you know, is worth going to, or you know, turning the page to move to a new chapter. And sometimes people are limited by the options they have. So you have suddenly two plans. Either I stay where I am and I wait until something happens, or I jump into an adventurous journey that is completely crazy, irrational. And I am someone by nature who jumps off a cliff and then checks if I have my parachute or if there is water underneath, which is not something I advise people to do, but this is just in my nature. And it was exactly that, you know, one day I just jumped from the cliff and I said, let's figure this out as we go. And it's quite a risky move and very, very challenging. Again, you were talking about the glamour of working in luxury. These days, and especially in the last 5 years, there was a lot of glamour around founders, especially in the tech world. You know, a founder can create a multi-billion dollar kind of company and become super rich and life is good. This, we're talking about 0.001% of people who do that. The reality is that the vast majority of startups fail, and people have to be ready for that eventuality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think it's quite interesting because now maybe it's also my bubble. I can only judge, you know, my own perspective, but I do think that now you hear and you read more and more about that side of the medal, let's say, that, you know, that we need to normalize talking about also like failure, and especially in certain parts of the world, like in the States, you fail, you get up, you try again. But in Western Europe, and especially the DACH region, it's really, no, you don't try. You either know 100% it's going to work or you don't try. And it's really important to talk about, you know, maybe not failing per se, but just how challenging it is. It's worth it in the end, or even the process is worth it. I've talked to a lot of people where they stopped, you know, their venture, but they still say they grew as a person tremendously and they wouldn't change it for a bit. But you need to talk about how, you know, it's not all fun and games every day?
The process is really the most important, and it's very difficult for a founder to enjoy the process on a daily basis because of all the challenges that you face really every day. And these challenges can be small or big. They can come from the left or the right, but they always come. And you learn a lot through the process without knowing it. And mm-hmm. whether you succeed or fail, you're absolutely right. At the end, you look back and you're like, wow, that was just an amazing experience. The there is a lot of mental health issues with founders that you know, people are starting to talk about, which is really great. But also founders should not be influenced too much by the podcasts they hear about the guy who sold his company for $1 billion or the successful founder who exited. And because these, again, are really the small, small, small minority. Yes, you always need to look up to someone or to a certain vision or aim so you can keep going. But also don't set the bar, you know, too high in terms of pressure. Pressure can break you. And you don't need to reach 1 billion. You know, you don't need to be a unicorn to be a successful startup. It's really about the process, the journey, and how far you can take it and what you learn along the way. Mm-hmm. And if you have the resilience and the perseverance and the courage to carry on, hardworking founders can make it. And obviously, in the hospitality industry, it's slightly different. You know, in tech, you can be 18 years old, working with some codes and coming up with something amazing and selling that code or that app and making a lot of money early on without much experience. In hospitality, or at least in the operations side of what we're doing, you need some experience. Yeah, investors or hotel owners cannot take you seriously if you say, look, I'm 20 year old, I just created my own brand and I want to manage your $100 million asset. So it's not comparable. Mm-hmm. So I encourage always students to say, oh, I want to run my own, you know, company or do my own business. So it depends on what you want to do. But if it's creating a brand or you know, you need some gray hair. Until you're able to do that. And I got a lot of gray hair after actually I launched Envy. It accelerated quite rapidly.
But it's all going to be worth it in the end. But maybe let's talk a bit about, you know, how you got started and where the idea came from for Envy Lodges, and how you also found your, you know, you have a co-founder. It's always, I hear a lot when I talk to entrepreneurs that that's one of the hardest things. You know, you might have a great idea, but then you need to build your core team who you can actually do it with and you can trust, right? So maybe let's start with this, like, you know, the idea and how you actually decided to jump off this cliff.
Yeah, when I'm speaking about liking niche brands, liking niche businesses, I started scouting the market and understanding who's doing what. And there are a few amazing brands that really I look up to who are doing an amazing job, but I didn't have the opportunity to maybe, you know, join them, or maybe they didn't want me. And then you start looking into trends and changes and transformation in the market in terms of habits and lifestyle and cultural shifts. When you do a lot of reading, listening to many podcasts and seeing where the industry is going, you started to map what the industry looks like and you would identify gaps. This is the process that I went through where I saw, look, there is this thing called outdoor hospitality that I was lucky enough to experience on a couple of occasions that seemed to be gaining traction. I started reading interviews from very famous architects and, you know, and people in the industry who were focusing on outdoor hospitality. And they were all saying the same thing. This is growing. It's the fastest growing segment of the industry. People want to be outdoor, the adventure travel, experiential travel. You know, every person has a different name for it, but it's all kind of basically being in nature. Yeah, it means the same thing. But everyone was saying there is not enough supply. There was a big concentration at that time about lifestyle hotels. It was all about lifestyle. So bigger hotels, you know, 100 keys, 200 keys. And I said, look, there is an opportunity to create something very exciting that I am partially familiar with, that I love as a person who likes, you know, adventure and going out there. And my family entrepreneurial genes kicked in. And this is how I think I, you know, I started working on a business plan. The company had no name. It was called No Name. Until I reached out to Noel, my co-founder. And I think you said, look, it's the most difficult task to find a co-founder or a core team. It's definitely the most important task. I would definitely advise any entrepreneur to select a co-founder. It's okay. You can split the pie. You don't need to have it all for yourself, but get someone that can help you along the way. It's so important. And I was so lucky to you know, to be working with Noel because we complement each other. I didn't want to find someone who is exactly like me, who just acts like a sounding board. You know, it's like looking yourself in the mirror. I wanted someone who has kind of a different personality. In the few years that we've been working together, I think we only had one major argument. I am someone who's very rational and can be black or white. And she has many shades of gray and very emotional, very rounded in her answer. So we, you know, we balance each other's. When I am down, she's up. When she's down, I'm up, so that we always find this balance. And it's very helpful because the challenges that you're going to face as an entrepreneur sometimes are too heavy to carry by yourself. Sometimes you don't want to share them with your family because you don't want them to worry about what's going on. You look at your friends, they're all super busy with their own life. It's not always easy to also share with them. So the only person on the same boat as you is your co-founder. And you know, it really helps to get that that core team close to you, so you're able to jump through all the bumps and bombs and everything that comes along the way.
Mm-hmm. And did you know Noel from before already, or did you already build that kind of trust before you started?
Yes, we had worked together, and I think it's important that you know your co-founder before you you choose someone. I know you, not everyone has that luxury. It's very difficult. It's funny, sometimes on LinkedIn I see a post saying looking for a co-founder.
Yes.
I'm like, that's so weird. Like, how can you just pick a co-founders from LinkedIn that you don't know? Sometimes you need a technical expert. So any, you know, tech guru can come in. In our case, I think the chemistry between the two of us was important. So having known each other for a few years, we knew that we would be a good, you know, match, the two of us. And, you know, I called her one day and said, do you want to do this? She said, absolutely. And she joined.
Wow. So you didn't have to do an elevator pitch or anything.
No, it took a few minutes only.
Wow. Not bad. So maybe you can give me and our audience, our listeners, the benefit of the doubt and do a little small introduction to Envy Lodges and, you know, what's your kind of mission and where you're positioned, and then we can go into a bit more you know, the product side and like where you are and what exciting things are going to happen.
We're an Ecolodge brand and management company, so we specialize in very small boutique properties of on average 20 to 40 keys, in locations that are quite remote sometimes. Even if you're close to a more urban environment, the site itself has to be completely immersed in nature. And I think this is very important for us, is finding the sites where we're able to create that immersion experience for our guests. And to be able to exist in such an environment, you have no choice but to be sustainable, to even be regenerative in some instances where the environment is quite damaged. So for us, it came just as a consequence of who we are. We want to be in a lodge brand immersed in nature. So our core brand and DNA and standards are all based on high levels of sustainability when it comes to the environment, the people, the method of constructions, the way we use some materials, the way where the food comes from, etc. So the really the essence of being a lodge in nature is to provide these exceptional experiences, transformational experiences, where people feel good. I think when you are close to nature, when you're on those amazing sites, there's a well-being aspect that is also embedded in who we are. It's not like, oh, let's do a spa. It's everything that you do when you're there, from walking in nature, from hugging a tree, from the way you sleep, from what you eat. You know, for me, our mission is to improve the well-being of people. And, you know, I sound like a medical expert, but no, within the hospitality space, I think the brands like ours, and there are some amazing others out there, I do hope that we're able to, at our own scale, contribute to the well-being of people. So we specialize in three types of accommodation: tents, canvas tents, modular construction, so it's low-impact villas or cabins or pods, that are either manufactured off-site or that are assembled on-site. And the third category is what we call alternative biophilic pods. These are using local materials like bamboo, mud, etc., to create very funky shapes, whether it's in the trees or on the water or between rocks, etc. And this is how we really mapped the concept of NV. And we said, okay, in 2021, it was we were ready to launch it in September, and we started to go out in the market to see which investors are keen on doing this with us. And surprisingly, we got pleasantly surprised to receive such a warm welcome.
Well, I mean, you know, the investors probably saw the same thing that you saw, or you were able to make them see what you see, and believe in you. So I think that's, I mean, you said you were surprised, because I think you probably, you know, you picture worst case scenario, so you're ready for the worst case scenario.
Always.
But, yeah. But I'm sure, the numbers were speaking for themselves, or the brand concept was speaking for itself. But I would be interested to know as well, first of all, what NV stands for, why you came up with the name. Is it coming from, you know, I'm NV, you know, is it that's the... No. Behind the brand name, or is something different?
No, we wanted a name that reflects the DNA of the brand, which is us being in nature. And ENVI is the first four letter of environment.
That makes more sense.
It's just that we wanted a name also that we could more easily register. So that's why we took the first four letters. But we had, you know, a list of names, and I think this is the one that stuck. And then we immediately started working on the brand and that identity and logo, which is the first kind of small win that you have as an entrepreneur. After you set up your company, you sign your shareholder agreement, you have your license, the logo is really like the first exciting thing that you do before you get into the more complicated parts of launching your own company.
It's a nice quick win, I can imagine, where you're, well, maybe it's not quick, but when you have that, you feel more, probably you also feel more like you're actually doing this, you know, it feels more professional, it feels more
real.
Yeah, yes, definitely. And on your website, I also saw that you have this ring classification system where you basically show the level of, I don't know how you would call it, level of comfort maybe, or like the star system in hotels, right? Like 5-star, 4-star, 3-star. But maybe you can share a bit more about this, because I really like the ring picture that you took from the trees, actually.
Correct. Yeah, actually, when you cut the trunk of a tree in a sustainable manner, please, the trunk has different rings that shows the age of the tree, right? So when we're actually coming up with the brand and with the concept, we quickly realized that although we operate in the luxury space from a service standpoint and experience standpoint, there is a difference between the facilities and the comfort you get in a treehouse that is maybe 35 square meter versus a 100 square meter tent with a plunge pool and an outdoor bathtub and, you know, all the luxury that comes with it. But I'm still giving you the same quality food, the same housekeeping, the same experience, the same connection with nature and et cetera, et cetera. So we said, okay, we need to separate not so much for the guest, but also from a development standpoint of how we categorize our lodges. We needed to make a distinction between different categories of the lodges that we'd be operating. The star system that you mentioned doesn't at all apply to what we do. And even if the local authorities want to give you a star, I really don't care what they do with their stars, because they judge the product. We are delivering an experience. It's a very different approach. Mm-hmm. So we said, let's create our own classification. And we have a matrix that defines, you know, for each ring categories, you know, the size of the units, the type of facilities that you have, whether you have plunge pools or not, you know, the investment that goes in it, the type of FF&E and all of that. And it came really at the beginning. It was really part of the brand creation. And mm-hmm. We see it especially with owners now that they get very excited when we get a new project. One of the first questions they say is like, in which ring category this project is going to fall, you know? Obviously, everyone wants a triple ring, which is the highest level that we have. But we really explain to them, you know, given the type of room rate that you have in that market, given the investment that you're going to put, it doesn't make sense to be a single ring, or it doesn't make sense to be a triple ring. So we try to bring a rationale to them to remove the emotional side.
Mm-hmm. And correct me if I'm wrong, but on the website, I think so far there's no triple ring property in the pipeline, right?
Well, because I really, really like you guys, because Mac is one of, you know, my best hospitality podcasts that has been in my ears since the creation of Envy. I want to give you an exclusive news.
Oh my God, only. Where's this going?
No, we're very, very happy that in the next few days, we will be opening a triple ring lodge, our first triple ring lodge in the National Park of the Serengeti in Tanzania. 11 amazing tents, two restaurants, a bar, a wellness facility, and an amazing wildlife on the concession and around. I mean, just by sitting on the deck of your tent, you'll be able to see and hear lions and elephants and giraffe without even going on the vehicle for your safari drive. So we're very excited about that. And we will be making shortly the official announcement of the opening. But the team is fully mobilized on site, doing the final training, the final push, and, you know, the fine tuning. And this is really a very important milestone for us, and we're so happy for the investors who chose Envy for that project.
Well, congrats. It sounds too good to be true. So I'm you know, I'm going to call my boyfriend after this episode and just tell him I already booked our next vacation. But it sounds really, really amazing. So thank you for, you know, sharing this news with our podcast listeners. I hope they all, you know, look it up now and will go. But it does indeed sound, you know, beautiful. And now that we've talked about the ring system, I'm just wondering, you know, one of the major challenges for your company must be kind of managing the expectations from the customers with, you know, because you are in a very removed environment. You are in nature. That's what the people also come for. But then again, I think no matter which ring you are, like the property is classified in, it's all rather high end. So they also probably have expectations that they arrive with. So managing that must be quite the challenge. So I'm wondering, you know, how you are going into this and how you anticipate and maybe manage this challenge, let's say.
Yeah, luxury hotels in general have this challenge, but when it comes to being off-grid and trying to be as sustainable as possible towards the environment, the people, and our guests, sometimes expectations can be different between what our guests think they want to have in terms of sustainability and comfort versus actually what they ask for is when they arrive on a specific site. There's obviously a difference we notice between travelers who are going to a national park like the Serengeti, between animals off-grid where the property operates on solar power, where you don't have all the ingredients available, you know, depending on what the farmers are able to give you on a daily basis. So their expectations are a bit more aligned with what the offering is going to be. But our mission, which is a very difficult mission, was to say, let's learn from that African safari experience, but let's export it globally. Let's try it in Europe. Let's try it in a harsh climate like Saudi Arabia or the UAE or Oman. Let's go to very extreme temperature in the desert. How can we still provide the comfort while, you know, adhering to our standards of sustainability and being responsible? How can you satisfy the very demanding needs of a high net worth individual who is spending $1,000 a night versus the realities and the availabilities of food, produce, etc. on the ground? It's a big challenge. Obviously, since we're opening our first few lodges in the next few months, by the end of next year, we should be up and running with 8 properties. Mm-hmm. So the challenge is starting now. Mm-hmm. It's an exciting challenge, but there are some elements of comfort that you cannot compromise on. You cannot operate in the desert if you don't have air conditioning. So if you need air conditioning, where does the power come from to mm-hmm. actually, you know, provide you with that comfort? And what do you do to compensate for that additional energy? How do you offset, etc.? I can go on and on about water, food, waste. It's really a big topic. And I think the industry, despite all the efforts that we are doing to be more sustainable, we're very, very, very far. I can add mm-hmm. a few more varies if you want from where we should be. Everything starts with a baby step, and we are all taking baby steps, which is great. But I'm always cautious about the promises that some companies do about carbon neutrality, etc., because the reality on the ground is quite difficult, you know. You know, some journalists or consultants or professors have theories as to how things go, but then I'm like, but you know, this is not your money. Put your money if you want us to really achieve that level, because the investors on the ground will say, look, Chris, I would love to have a water desalination plant. I would love to have a solar farm. But you know how much it costs? Do you know how you can get me that return on investment? You know, let's try to be as responsible as we can, take into consideration the realities available today from a technology, supply chain, etc., etc. So there are many things that we are doing in terms of sustainability. When it comes to operation, this is in our control. But also the heavy equipment, the CapEx, can be challenging for investors.
Mm-hmm. And do you sometimes get a bit frustrated when, you know, you see certain brands or companies, like there's so much greenwashing going on in the industry, where you, I don't know, I think as a normal customer, as a guest, trying to inform yourself, you're probably sometimes also a bit lost, a bit overwhelmed. You want to do the right thing, but you want to get the information. But then from a brand perspective, it's also hard to really get across how much you are doing and how serious you are taking it. So yeah, I'm just wondering, you know, how you navigate this as well, because it must be frustrating to then kind of fall in the same pot with other brands where you know it's not the same level of dedication to the cause.
Yes, yes, it's true. I mean, we are, first of all, lucky that we're starting from scratch. So the standards that we put from the beginning is easier than someone who already has, you know, 3,000 hotels, concrete buildings somewhere that are consuming a lot of air conditioning. So definitely we have an advantage. But also I feel that people in general may be confused about the meaning of greenwashing or maybe using it in the wrong way. So if a company is lying, then definitely there is greenwashing. But if a company says, I'm not going to use plastic straws, for instance, just to use a silly example, so therefore I'm sustainable, it's not greenwashing. I mean, you are doing some efforts to be more sustainable, but you're very, very far from being where you should be. But at least you're doing something about it. So lying definitely is something that we should not tolerate, but we should also be encouraging companies who may use the word a bit more in an exaggeration form, mm-hmm. but actually there is something behind it. Mm-hmm. And as an industry, we should be supporting each other, not criticizing each other, you know, same with the media, same with, you know, different parts of the industry. So I think we're going into the right direction, but there is, a long way still to get there.
Mm-hmm. So we're nearing the end of the podcast episode, unfortunately, but I want to talk about one thing before we end, and because I'm getting very excited about this. So I read that you earlier this year announced your collaboration with an investor in France. So can we, you know, get excited about Envy coming to Europe anytime soon?
I hope so. I hope so. We are very, very closely working with our partner in France on multiple sites to be able to announce, hopefully soon, the first of a few lodges in France. We are also working on a super opportunity in Italy, in Greece, in some parts of Eastern Europe. So there is a lot of traction for us at the moment in Europe. The focus at the moment is on Africa and the Middle East, but we're mm-hmm. slowly also, you know, increasing our time and efforts in Europe. Now, in some countries in Europe, as you know, and you live in one of them, the legal aspect and the administrative aspect of
yes.
getting permits on the land that we are interested in is like climbing the Everest because people put hurdles to each other just for the, you know, I don't know. I think sometimes municipalities set up processes and an approval chain that is meant to fail by default. You will never be able to reach an approval if you have to go through those hoops. And there is a lot of fear when it comes to giving an operator or an investor actually a land in a forest or on a farm, because this is what mm-hmm. we look for. We're not looking at downtown Paris. We need large plots of land in nature where there is wildlife or something really exciting. And obviously, for the good reason, they want the municipalities want and the mayors want to protect that environment because it's really the richest of, you know, what makes France such a diverse and rich country, geographically speaking. And from a topography standpoint. So they want to preserve it. And when someone comes and says, I want to do a tourism project in this amazing forest, yeah. well, you really have to convince them that you are sustainable and you care for the environment and you're going to support the local communities and you're not going to hire all, you know, employees from outside, etc. So it takes us more efforts to get projects in Europe compared to, for instance, mm-hmm. Africa or the Middle East.
Mm-hmm. Well, just don't give up, please, because I mean, I'll also travel very far for you guys, but it would be we would be very happy to welcome you to Europe very soon. Are you ready for your last question?
Oh, okay.
I mean, you also listen to Smack and to my episodes, so you know that I usually end with the same questions for all my guests. And if you could travel back in time with all the experiences that you have now, what would you tell your, younger self just coming out of uni or just starting out in the industry? What is something that you would like to pass on or you wish you had known?
Wow. It's important to be patient when you graduate. It's important that you try different things, that you put yourself at risk, because this is an amazing experience that you will benefit from later on. You should not really stick to a very safe kind of career path because, you know, you want to become a GM, so you want to go through all the hoops and stay in the same company with the same. You're at an age where you should take risks, and success will come later if you're patient. And especially for those who want to be entrepreneurs, take your time. Learn from that journey, from that process. Find mentors. Be attentive. Listen. Always be curious, because you will know one day when you're ready to take that that jump. And I know that, you know, our generation and the one after me is quite impatient, and, you know, they always want to get to the top very quickly. But definitely enjoy that journey and learn, because it's really invaluable.
Well, very, very good last words. Thank you so much, Chris, for being on the podcast. It was a true joy. I hope to see you in the flesh very soon and visit one of your lodges. And all the best for you. And thank you for taking the time.
Thank you, Pat. It was great speaking to you today.
That's it for this episode, everybody. Thank you for tuning in. Don't forget to share your thoughts on this episode and everything else that is going on at Smack with us by checking out our website at smack.media, or connect with us on LinkedIn, YouTube, or Instagram. We'll see you next time.